There's an onus on the individual to engage in training. So put your ego aside, be enthusiastic, be vulnerable, get in there, you know, make a fool of yourself in training. That's the best time to do it and learn from that. Don't hang back and be a bit too sort of, you know, worried that you might be exposed. That's the time to do it. So there's a requirement there to get in and train, take every opportunity you can.
Hey team, welcome back to another episode of the Student Paramedic Podcast. Hey team, welcome back to another episode of the Student Paramedic Podcast. If you're new, my name's Alex and today I'm sitting down with Britt Shaw, who was our very first guest on this podcast. So hey Britt.
Hey guys, it's so good to be back. Thanks for having me back, Alex.
Oh, anytime. And today we're having a chat to Dr. Dan Pronk. Now, Dr. Pronk completed SAS selection and has worked in special operations. He's received a commendation for distinguished service in his second tour of Afghanistan. And as if medicine wasn't enough, he completed an MBA, has worked as a doctor outside of the army and is the medical director of TAC Med Australia. So Dr. Dan, his brother Ben and Tim Curtis have also written The Resilient Shield, which we'll probably have a little bit of a chat about today, and how we can apply some resilience techniques founded in sort of SAS style of training into the paramedic sort of world that we will be in. So, Dr. Dan, thank you for coming on.
Absolute pleasure. Thank you for having me, Alex and Britt.
Awesome. Well, I gave you just a little bit of an introduction, but I'd love to know sort of a little bit more about you and your story before we kick off into things.
Yeah, of course. So I came out of school very interested in sports, a triathlon at the time, and pursued triathlon for about 5 years, trying to crack it as a professional triathlete. And that didn't come to fruition. So I sort of thrashed that for 5 years, and it was pretty clear I wasn't going to reach the level that was going to be professionally sustainable or that I could make a living from. So had to look elsewhere. In that 5 years, I'd done an exercise science degree up on the Gold Coast. I'd done that part-time while I was training and racing and really enjoyed it. I found it relevant. I hadn't done fantastically at school. I'd done well enough to get into that degree, but really sort of hit my straps, if you like, academically during that. Loved it, could see the relevance, really enjoyed it, and did all right at it. So when I popped out the other end of my triathlon, I started to look at, well, you know, what now? And I had this exercise science degree that in itself, this was the mid-90s, quite possibly before either of you were born, I fear, but I'm getting old now. But the exercise science at that point wasn't really a big field. And so didn't really want to work in that field, wasn't a lot of job opportunity. So started looking at, my dad had been an army helicopter pilot, so was familiar with the army. My brother had gone into the army by that point. Started to look at the military and specifically the army as a career option, but also sat the graduate entry medical school admission test, so to try and get into med school as a second degree. Managed to get into both of those things, and they came together, and I did medicine on an army scholarship in the end. So I did my med school, a couple of years as a junior doc in civilian hospitals, and then moved into the military. So I posted to my first army unit in 2007. I had, along that time, when I was at med school, my brother had done SAS selection. So he'd finished his officer training, gone into the army, finished his officer training and done some time in infantry, did SAS selection, was over with SASR. And so I got this insight into what special operations looked like and decided that I'd love to have a go at getting into that environment. So first chance I could, which was 2008, I hopped on the SAS selection course and managed to get my way through that course, and that led to the remainder of my career in special operations. So that was sort of the pathway that led me down the tactical medical path.
That's awesome. That seems like an extensive sort of, I guess, journey into what is an amazing career. So thanks for sharing that. So I guess to kick things off first and foremost, before we sort of jump into resilience, what sort of situations, I guess, have you been in during your time in special operations? I know you share this a little bit in the book, that really did test your resilience as such and really require you to bring sort of, I guess, calm into a really chaotic situation.
I think the first real test was the SAS selection course. That was just a fantastic test of resilience, physical, but more so psychological. So that's a 3-week course. And that was really brilliant. But in terms of operationally, I was very fortunate to come into roles that at a time when the Australian Army as a whole and Defence Force and particularly Special Operations were being deployed quite frequently. And so I ended up doing 4 tours of Afghanistan and in that period of time managed to project forward into the field. And so to come back to your question from a medical perspective, there was quite a number of opportunities to do pre-hospital medical care in a combat environment, so treating blast, specifically blast and gunshot, high-velocity gunshot wound in that pre-hospital setting, but within the in really complex environments, so often ongoing gunfights, often nighttime operating on night vision. So these really sort of volatile, complex, ambiguous kind of scenarios. And so all of the, and we were very well trained within special operations, which was fantastic. We had a lot invested into us to be able to function at the level we needed to in that environment. And thankfully, those skills were there for me at those times. And it was an environment, you know, I mean, paramedics, of course, operate in these similar sort of circumstances. Hopefully no one's shooting at you, but you're pre-hospital. It's often, you know, ambiguous. You don't really know the patient. There can be quite a threat. And we know that occupational violence is huge. In paramedics are getting assaulted all the time. So it's the same sort of fundamentals, this pre-hospital, undefined casualty, trying to do your best to stabilise in these complex environments where you need to remain situationally aware and try and practice best medicine. So, you know, that was the environment I found myself in and really enjoyed and have sort of since seen all these parallels with resilience specifically in other domains and particularly paramedicine.
From reading through of the Resilience Shield, so anyone who doesn't know who's listening, the Resilience Shield was a book that you popped out with your brother and with Tim. Did you find that being able to sort of sit down with the others and being able to look back on your time, you were able to better identify the moments of resilience that you had over the whole picture as opposed to sort of when you were going through, was it more that just trying to get, you know, the next day or the next best step and things like that?
Yeah, you know, that's a great question, Britton. You're exactly right. It was only on reflection that we started to see these patterns and these trends and these attributes and these factors that bolstered resilience. At the time, you're in the middle of all that and you're just trying to do your best job. And it was such a dynamic environment that you just bounced from one thing to the next, to the next, to the next. And you just had to keep going. And there was a lot of critical incidents in among all of that, but there was always a distraction, something else to go to, and which could be quite protective, to be honest. It didn't leave a lot of time to sit around and reflect or stew on things or, you know, that. But that said, a lot of that stuff, it doesn't go away. It's there. And once again, to draw this to paramedicine, there's a lot of parallels there as well. You know, paramedics are flat strapped, busy. You might bounce from a job where something horrendous occurs. You have these really traumatic exposures. But guess what? There's still a job to do. And you get another call, you go to the next one. And it's this never-ending roller coaster of ups and downs. But to draw it back to your question, yeah, it was only after I got out of the army that I started to struggle a little bit, which I found paradoxical because I was never safer. I was earning more money. I was home with my family. And yet from a mental health perspective, I was really just having a worse time than I ever had when I was deploying to Afghanistan or in, you know, high risk situations where my life was legitimately at risk. And so it was sort of that period afterwards of of observing that this was happening to me, and it was paradoxical because I was safe and at home, and it was, well, hang on, what was it? What were those factors that bolstered me when I was with the army that I've lost? What's left me vulnerable to this stress? And that was what kind of directed me in towards looking at resilience as a construct and teaming up with Ben and Tim to write the book.
Yeah, and I think something like that, it's very, I guess, current to the current group that are coming through, like these newly qualified paramedics or the students that are listening. I think getting this episode out, it's going to give them that opportunity to jump onto it, because I think so many of them don't realise that, you know, especially the ones who started out first year, at the first year of the pandemic, they've just been pushing through and just going, I guess, you know, from big moment to big moment without really that chance to sort of stop and pause. You know, placements are being disrupted, assessments are changing, the way that they're coming through, even the graduates are coming out. And like you say, they're hitting the ground running. We're not stopping while we're on shift, so they don't get that sort of that calm moment. I think this is going to be something that we potentially do see in a year or two's time when, you know, the dust has settled a bit more and they have that moment of realization of what they've just gone through and that exhaustion, I guess, that sort of all, I guess, caught up to them.
Agree completely. And having thought long and hard about this, I think there's different stages of awareness of the stress of these roles. And when you're newly in the role, of course, there's the learning curve and there's the professional stimulus and satisfaction and the requirement to learn skills, be exposed to traumatic scenarios for your own learning and growth and to build your capability. And there can be a lot of excitement involved in that, doing things for the first time and then building competence and then demonstrating competence in complex situations is hugely professionally rewarding. And what I think happens with first responder groups across the board and paramedics specifically is it's a certain kind of person that moves into paramedicine. And so there's probably already a fair bit of innate resilience and a personality construct that wants to get involved, wants to help and wants to test themselves. Then they get trained and they go into the role and then they start on this rapidly moving treadmill of experiences, positive and negative, traumatic and all the rest of it. But it takes some time for that to start to accumulate and potentially have an effect. And what happens during that period is you recalibrate. So there's a thing called hedonic adaptation, and it's a human tendency to adjust to new levels of normal if you're in a scenario for a period of time. And if you're a paramedic and you're day in, day out seeing what a paramedic sees, that becomes your new normal. And you can lose reference point to the fact that from a human psychological perspective, the exposures and encounters in a paramedic's day or career are very abnormal. You know, the average person over a lifetime might have one or two what's called lifetime critical incidents. So being either their life was at threat or they've seen someone else's life at threat or they've seen death, they've seen destruction, all this sort of stuff. Is the average person might have one or two of those, and you have a look at a career in paramedicine, you're probably having hundreds of those, but you adjust to that. That's your normal, and so you don't see anything abnormal about that, but on a physiological level, your body is keeping score. So that trauma sort of adds up. You get better at better and better at dealing with those situations. But it's, and I like the analogy of a bucket. There's this psychological bucket that's filling up, and you won't notice that until it starts to get close to overflowing. And that's where you start to see a few chinks in the armor, and then it sort of overflows. And you look back and think, gee, you know what? There was a lot of exposures over a lot of years. So I think you're quite correct with, you know, newly graduated paramedics coming in with the added pressure of the COVID landscape at the moment that's just really tightened the screws on everything, but that's their normal. That's the only normal they know, and it's very abnormal.
I think you guys bring up really amazing points, and in particular, as you both mentioned, but having this awareness that, you know, this is what you're going to see, you know, this is the type of stress you may be under. And as you said, having that sort of adaptation, Dr. Prong, as you said, you know, over time you will get, you know, this hedonic adaptation to what you see on a daily basis. It does definitely come into, I think, that understanding of being really proactive then about understanding these topics of resilience and how to build this now as a student whilst you're going through such a challenging time, whether that be, you know, as Britt mentioned, with placements being cancelled or rescheduled or just disrupted, in particular, just that whole learning environment disrupted. I think it's a great point then to jump into paramedics, as you mentioned, will generally have higher rates of mental, physical health issues than the general public. And as you mentioned, you know, that is generally due to, you know, the nature and the unique environment that is paramedicine. So what is, you know, resilience? Because we keep throwing this around. What is resilience? And what can we do to get, I guess, start being proactive in our way of managing it?
So to talk to the question of what is resilience, that in itself is something that's a topic of debate, and there's no one agreed upon definition of resilience. The one we like is a better than expected outcome given the adversity faced. And so, I mean, when you look at the literature on resilience, some groups think it is a post-event construct, so something that happens after a critical stress event, and that's like the bouncing back analogy. So you take a hit and you bounce back. Other groups think it's a pre-existing construct, something that's inherent to a system, or in this instance, a human, that allows them to endure stress without a loss of function. And others think it's a little from column A, a little from column B. And indeed, that's what our research project has shown. But I think that better than expected outcome given the adversity faced is a good one. There's two things that need to be demonstrated for, or two factors that are agreed upon for resilience to have been demonstrated. One is the better than expected outcome. If you fall in a heap and you stay there, that's not resilience. And the other one is there needs to be a stress to be resilient against. You can be going along, and if everything's going fine, you can't display resilience. It's not that you're not resilient, it's just you haven't been able to display it because there's no stress. So better than expected outcome, and there needs to be a stress. And then when it comes to how do we build this, and that was the question that we asked ourselves, Ben, Tim and I, when we sort of started to look at this. How is it that as soldiers in our instance, but, you know, insert any stressful career, including paramedicine here, or not even career, you know, the parents that are up all night, single mums that are working and raising a kid, insert sort of life stress here that we're all under. What are the factors that we know bolster us to be able to endure that stress? Why is it that some people do come apart from a mental or physical health perspective and others endure it, whereas others thrive in the face of it? And so this was what we were looking at. And for me personally, it was what were the factors that were present when I was a doctor with the Army that kept me going despite this years and years of these high tempo operations and critical incident exposures? What were they? And if I can work that out, how do I proactively build them rather than wait for this stress event to occur and me to fall into a bit of a heap to then dig myself out of that? If I know what they are, let's get ahead of the curve. And there's a great passage from Marcus Aurelius, and part of it talks about getting active in your own rescue. And so Marcus Aurelius, a famous Stoic philosopher and Roman emperor, and we loved this get active in your own rescue. It's very empowered and positive and proactive, and that's a bit of a feature in our book. And so we started to look at the literature and started to dig into the resilience literature and what had been shown from studies to be causative of resilience, what we knew from the science caused resilience. And then we started to build up this model of resilience, what we thought it looked like across a bunch of layers. And so they were your innate layer. So there's nature and nurture, there's genetic and epigenetic factors that we know are causative or related to resilience. Your mind layer, so your mindset, your mindfulness, your optimism, your gratitude, things like growth mindset, things like an internal locus of control. There's a bunch of factors there that we know are critical to resilience. So mind layer is very important, and it's one we can train. Body layer, sleep, diet, exercise, health, fitness, particularly sleep was the one that really moved the needle on resilience there. Then you've got your social layer, how well socially supported you are and close interpersonal relationships. You know, it makes sense that if you've got people close to you, they'll support you through times of hardship. Your professional layer, so how good you are at your role, your virtuosity, but your purpose, where you can see sense in the role and a bigger picture in the role that you're doing and feel like you're contributing to something meaningful and bigger than yourself. And then around it all, we put this adaptation layer. There needed to be some recognition that you can build resilience, you can build confidence to approach tasks that you don't even know are coming yet. So the kind of confidence to approach these unknown stressors that can pop out of the blue. And so that was the framework, this model that we started to formulate. And then we decided we wanted to prove it. It wasn't enough just to say the literature says this, or we used to be in the army and we did this and we thought we were resilient. So we managed to get a federal government research grant. We generated a resilience survey. So that sits on our website, resilienceshield.com. You can hop on and do that for free. And that gives you a resilience score. You do the survey, you get an overall resilience score, but it also gives you sub-scores across four layers. So your mind, body, social, and professional. And so not only does that quantify resilience, it also allows you to individually look at where you're strong and where you're not as strong. And then you can tailor your resilience interventions to focus on your areas of relative weakness to improve your overall resilience shield.
That's awesome. And I think the amazing thing about your book is that it just goes through all of those points so clearly. And I think most people generally overcomplicate it. And so I think your book is something that everyone listening to this should definitely go read, so they can hash out all of these points of resilience. And as you mentioned, finding out in the survey on the website as well, where you're strong and where you're not strong in these particular areas. Now, you did mention at the start in regards to stress and what is stress. And we always think of it in a negative light. So we always think stress is bad. But as you mentioned there, you know, stress has to have some part of it that is good in order to be able to demonstrate resilience. So do you mind just delving a little bit into that and sort of relating it to the area that is sort of pre-hospital environment?
Yeah, for sure. So stress, as you said, we normally have negative connotations. When we hear stress, we think we need to minimize all stress, get rid of stress. Stress is always bad, but there is a requirement for stress in our lives to demonstrate resilience, as we spoke of before, but also to perform optimally. And there's a well-known, some really old sort of formative literature in the stress in research of stress that looked at stress and performance, and a couple of researchers by the name of Yerkes and Dodson came up with this stress performance curve. And it's what's known as an inverted U, which is exactly as it sounds. So it's sort of a U turned upside down, and along the vertical axis you've got your performance, along the horizontal axis you've got your stress. And what it shows us is that if you have no stress, so right at the start of the inverted U, your performance is low. There's nothing to prime you for optimal performance. You're just understimulated and it's hard to engage and perform optimally. As your stress goes up, your performance goes up to a point, and so you hit the top of that U, and that's when you're primed for optimal performance. Then once you start pushing the stress past that, you get on the backside of that U and it starts to come back. Your performance starts to come back down. You start to get into overwhelm and exhaustion and burnout and these sort of things. And you can, the Yerkes-Dodson is applicable both acutely, so a stress situation, if you're a paramedic and you respond to a job and there's something in front of you that's stressful, be it a heart attack or a traumatic amputation or a drowned kid or something like that, you know, you will have this acute stress response, and depending on your skill set or your resilience and your level of training to deal with that situation will depend on where that stress sits on your Yerkes-Dodson inverted U. So if you're a well-trained paramedic who's got some experience in that field and comes across that scenario, that might be you primed for optimal performance. And I'm sure there's people listening who have found themselves in these high stress situations, you know, engaged and absolutely thriving. And often after that, you'll come away with feeling quite euphoric and feeling quite, you know, high as a kite if you've performed well in that scenario. If it's pushed too far, that's when you can start to get a bit overwhelmed and traumatized by the situation. And so the stress is a relative thing. It's relative to the individual. It's relative to the training. The other point before I leave Yerkes-Dodson is There's the ability to move that optimal point to the right. So push your optimal performance into higher levels of stress. And that's what we call a stress inoculation. And that's a training effect. So that's why there's so much training in a paramedicine qualification. That's why there's so much emphasis on reality-based training, the trainers you're going to fight, high fidelity training, although there's some discussion as to whether fidelity is as important as we initially thought. But certainly, the more training you do, the more stress inoculation you get, and the better you can perform in higher stress scenarios. And that's pushing that Yerkes-Dodson to the right. When we look at the physiology of how stress affects us, it comes back to the body's HPA axis, so the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis. This is our fight or flight mechanism that's hardwired into us. It's our reptilian brain that wants to fire. So when we have stimulus, it wants to prime our body to fight or flight. It primes our body for activity. And I think most people listening understand the fight or flight mechanism and how it primes us. It pumps up our heart rate. It gets our breathing rate going, constricts our pupils and gets us really focused. You know, you might get a little bit of sweating, which is a function of cooling you down and all of this sort of physiological effect. But this is a physiological stress response that can be triggered and is often triggered by a psychological stimulus. So you find yourself in a situation and that will fire this stress response. Your body reacts in a predictable way, and that ideally will prime you for optimal performance. But if it's firing a bit too much, it can throw you into overwhelm and push you past that optimal point in the Yerkes-Dodson. And one really quick sort of plug, if I might, before we move off that, we know unquestionably that a meditation practice or any form of mindfulness training, but a meditation, dedicated meditation practice, can help reduce that that fight or flight response in an acute setting, and can also reduce your chronic stress levels. We know it decreases the chronic stress hormone cortisol. And if there's one thing I can recommend that people take away from this, it's go and start meditating. Doesn't need to be lots, 10 minutes a day, 3 to 5 times a week. The studies show makes a huge difference. So that's my main plug here. Work on the mind layer and start meditating. Everyone listening.
That's brilliant. So when you're sort of looking at these, I guess, like these peak performance moments, so when that, you know, the adrenaline's kicked in, I think everyone listening will have had that experience at some point. And I really like the fact that you touched on that it's sort of that fluid point. It will change with your career. I remember, you know, first year placement, you're turning up at a job and just taking a blood pressure was, you know, that was a daunting moment. Whereas now that performance point's shifted. So now it's okay, you know, landing a helicopter on the motorway and managing a major trauma patient, that might be where my point kicks in. How did you sort of develop that ability to remain calm in the chaos? So, you know, I can't imagine what it's like being in those war zones where you've got, you know, all of your senses are firing off. You've got the sound, like the sounds, the sights, the smells, and I guess like that personal pressure. How do you then bring in all of those things to be able to be that good operator while it's happening?
The credit for any of that belongs elsewhere. It doesn't belong to me. It belongs to the organisation and the selfless people within the special operations medical community that put time into me to train me, if I'm being honest. Like I look back and I think it's always tempting to, you know, take personal credit for any of that, but it doesn't. I don't think it belonged with any of the individuals. I think it belonged with the organisation that prepared us so well, and it was through very, very well structured and incrementally stressful training. And, you know, things like you mentioned the first time you take a blood pressure, I look back as any paramedic would at things that are now commonplace and second nature. You do them with your eyes shut, that at one point were stressful and challenging sort of scenarios, but it is through repeated training in those individual component skills, and then very gradually but deliberately building them up into composite skills. And that's what you do in your paramedicine training. You learn to take a blood pressure, you learn to do this, you learn to do a primary survey and whatever else, and then you start to piece it together in a whole patient assessment in the classroom, and then you start to push that out into the field, and so it gradually builds in complexity and stimulus. But what you're doing is slowly but surely pushing that Yerkes-Dodson to the right, and they did this unbelievably well in the special operations world in general, but certainly in the special operations medical world. We were so well trained, and by cardiothoracic surgeons, vascular surgeons, anaesthetists, you name it. We had this amazing panel of selfless people that took their time to train us, that by the time we hit the ground in places like Afghanistan and you found yourself in a combat casualty scenario, I remember without trying to talk myself up, after the first time I treated a gunshot wound, I was underwhelmed because the level of complexity that we'd been trained in was these mass casualty situations at night. You're overwhelmed. You're reverse triaging. You're doing this. You're doing that. You're on night vision. Everything's happening and it goes for hours. And then I found myself in the middle of the day in Afghanistan and it was a single casualty with one gunshot wound. And I'm like, is that it? It just came back to that. I don't mean to be flippant about that at all, but the point I'm trying to illustrate is if you get the training right, and if you there's two responsibilities there. One is there's an onus on the individual to engage in training. So put your ego aside, be enthusiastic, be vulnerable, get in there. Make a fool of yourself in training. That's the best time to do it and learn from that. Don't hang back and be a bit too worried that you might be exposed. That's the time to do it. So there's a requirement there to get in and train, take every opportunity you can. But also if you're in a leadership type role of any level, be it formal or informal leadership, where you can organize training, do it every chance you get, because the more you can do that, the more you're programming your skill set into what's called unconscious competence. So programmed on muscle memory, it doesn't take bandwidth. And there's great studies, we talk to them in the book, that look at what part of your brain is firing when you're doing skills. And really familiar skills are almost automated. And people will have experienced this driving their car. You can, if you're an experienced driver, you hop in, you get from point A to point B. And sometimes you might think, geez, I wonder what happened there. Like, was that light green or whatever else? It's all happening on autopilot. And that's the same principle. You want to program your key, in our instance, tactical medical skills, into that unconscious competence state. So they happened on autopilot and you could concentrate your executive function on situational awareness, on communication, on these higher order functions that are required in complex and particularly tactical environments.
I love that you bring in sort of like that unconscious competence side of things. So in the other book that you've got out, so The Average 70 Kilo Dickhead, I loved a story that you've got in there about where you sort of mentioned like the Dunning-Kruger effect. So I guess sort of a bit like the flip side of that, and in the story, I won't give anything away. Everyone can go out and get the book and have a good read of it. But it was when you're a new doctor and doing a procedure on a female patient. And I loved hearing, I guess, sort of, that reminder that I guess all of us go through this. So further, like with the Dunning-Kruger effect, like that peak of Mount Stupid and the Valley of Despair, like I can distinctly remember the feeling of hitting the Valley of Despair after a job one time. And it's, I guess, bringing that in with the resilience of being able to bring yourself back up and go, okay, this is a normal part of the process. This is now how I'm going to improve it. Did you sort of find that by, being surrounded by other people with that same sort of drive and push to improve, that you were able to come up as a team, I guess, through those and, I guess, build that resilience throughout the process?
Yeah, absolutely. It was a really privileged position to hold, to be honest, even just to be in that special operations environment. And I had the good fortune of serving with both the SAS regiment and also the 2nd Commando Regiment. So, got the best of both worlds there over my career. And even to be in that environment was just fantastic, because it was a highly motivated, it was easy, if you like, to motivate yourself to excel, because that not only was that the standard required, but you were surrounded by other people pushing in that same direction. And also at that stage, we were very mission focused. Afghanistan, we were on high rotation over there. And so there was this higher purpose, this service, and which most people who join the military, I think, certainly myself, I wanted to go to war. That was my objective. That was what I wanted to do, to test this skill set in the ultimate arena, if you like, and play that game of life and death, which sounds terrible, but that was for me the ultimate sort of evolution of my training was to go and do this for real, and got the chance to do that. But being surrounded by a group that wanted to do that, and particularly the smaller group of tactical medics, so the medics that I had the privilege of leading as the doctor, although I use that term sort of fairly loosely, if I'm being honest. I think that they led me most of the time. They're a brilliant bunch, but yeah, it was excellent. And we were at a point where tactical medicine was evolving, and Australia was really just starting to progress along the TCCC tactical combat casualty care pathway. And so there was a lot of progress. We could see that what we were doing was saving lives. And so it was very meaningful for me. It really was very fulfilling. And to come back to your question, a very easy environment to stay highly motivated, which then, to bring that full circle to our earlier discussion, meant that we were all constantly seeking more and more exposure, which meant more cumulative trauma that we didn't know was happening at the time, and that everyone's trying to make the best sense of now with hindsight. So coming back to the paramedicine piece, lots of parallels there, and it's a bit of a trap to fall into when you're well, certainly for me as a junior doctor. And with that Dunning-Kruger, I mean, I think the way to avoid that, and Dunning-Kruger talks, basically it's mapping confidence against competence. So how good you think you are versus how good you actually are. And the real trap, that peak of Mount Stupid, Britt, that you were referred to, is when your confidence, your belief in your skill massively outstrips your competence. And I think a good way of overcoming that is being very introspective and being very honest with yourself. And if you start to feel really confident in a certain situation, make sure that is backed by tangible competence. Make sure that you can say, hey, you know, I'm pretty confident cannulating, for instance, but I can back that confidence because I've done this training course, I've done that, I've done 250 on the job, I hardly miss it all. And so that's not Dunning-Kruger, that is actually competence. Whereas if you stand up and say, yeah, I'm awesome at intubating because I did 2 on a mannequin 3 years ago in my training, then you're on the peak of Mount Stupid, and that's going to go disastrously wrong.
That's awesome. Well, thank you for sharing that. And to talk to you, to your point, Britt, about being on peak stupid, I had that moment as a grad a few weeks ago in ED, and I was just like, wow, I've got a lot more to learn. So I really love that point, because it happens to everyone, I feel, at multiple points during your journey. And it brings up a good point, and it's like you did talk about in the book, Dan, is around that imposter syndrome. So I feel like on my grad, imposter syndrome all day, every day, and I feel like everyone feels that way too. Like, how on earth do we overcome this? And is it part of this whole resilient shield?
Yeah, look, and Britt, put your hand up, and I'm right there with the pair of you in terms of feeling that imposter syndrome. And for those who might not be as familiar with that term, it's fundamentally as it sounds, this feeling that you hold a position that you may not be completely qualified for or entitled to. And it's almost the polar opposite of Dunning-Kruger. So a Dunning-Kruger scenario is someone who thinks they're awesome, but they're not actually qualified to be thinking that way. And often with imposter syndrome, it's generally found in people who are really quite competent, but have a fantastic amount of insight into their own levels of competence, and can often see these hypothetical scenarios where they'll be out over their depth and fear that they'll be exposed, that at some point you'll get called out. And I would argue that a degree of imposter syndrome is healthy, because it prevents the Dunning-Kruger scenario. But and the same thing with the Dunning-Kruger that I was talking about before, to alleviate imposter syndrome, I think if you can look at the position you're in and that you feel like you're a bit of an imposter in, and certainly Ben, Tim and I talk a lot about this, and it's certainly something we all deal with, you know, I mean, and this was something we threw around, who are we to be writing a book on resilience? Who are we to be, you know, talking about this, that or the other? And if you can kind of stack up a couple of reasons why that might be, you might be the right person to do that, then that can start to alleviate. If you've got a track record or a CV that suggests you are actually okay at whatever you're claiming to be okay at, or whatever position you might hold, then you should be in that position. And I think another thing here, something I heard many years ago, is no one will ever come and ordain you as a subject matter expert in something. You've got to step up and basically hold that ground yourself, or declare yourself as that. And so, you know, with the whole imposter syndrome, by virtue of that, you need to put yourself out there, test and adjust, you know, put some information out there, see what comes back, keep working on improving yourself in any given area. But certainly, if you have got tangible evidence that you are qualified to be in the position you're in, then you're not an imposter.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting when you sort of look at, like, the fact that you mentioned that no one comes and ordains you as that subject matter expert. Because I, you know, a couple of weeks ago, went to a cardiac arrest on road, and I was the most experienced clinician there. And if you'd have asked me 30 minutes before that job, I would have absolutely just laughed at the fact that I would walk in and have, you know, two officers still in their traineeships and another qualified officer who was only barely had just really like sort of recently qualified. And you sort of have to have that moment of, okay, this is how it is, and this is how I now need to step up and trust the training and trust that I've done the correct stress inoculation to be able to have that moment of doing it. But you still walk away, and I had that moment. I looked around and I was like, where's the next adult? Where is my person? And so it's that really interesting moment of, I guess, looking back on it after the job and being like, okay, I do have the ability. I've got the backing behind it. I've done the training. I do have that. But I think if you'd have, like I sort of said, if you'd have asked me an hour before the job, I wouldn't have had that belief that could have followed through like that, which is a really interesting sort of, I guess, like calm in the chaos moment where you just push through, and then it's the hindsight that makes that reality sort of sit in.
And that's fantastic. And it's those situations that really, if you thrive in the face of that adversity, that really build resilience, and that then resets your point of calibration to approach cardiac arrest to have a new degree of confidence. You're like, well, I dealt with this last time. We had a good result. And I think also that you mentioned the point of reflection. So afterwards, thinking back, and that's a very important thing to do, to do, you know, in the military, we call it after action reviews. So have a look at what happened, particularly critical incidents, draw out the good points and reinforce them. Well, first of all, look at what happened and try not to let emotion sort of, don't look at it through a lens of emotion. Look at the cold hard facts. What happened? If you can generate a timeline, absolutes, then that's great. And say, what went well? Reinforce those points. What could have been improved? And they're the things that you can do better next time. So that's how you continually evolve. But if you've had that experience and been chucked in the deep end and you've swum, as it sounds you did, then that's your new normal. And so that's where this Dunning-Kruger, that's where this Yerkes-Dodson starts to push to the right. You start to reset, and you can confidently approach more and more stressful situations and function at that optimal level.
That's really awesome. Such a really important point. And I think you guys brought up some amazing points there before. And in particular, the one that I want to go back to really quickly was what you were talking about, Dan, was about really utilizing your time for training to get in and actually be vulnerable and to practice and do what you, you know, need to do in training in order to be able to do it properly on the job. And it's something that I only spoke to some students at USQ about this week, was actually having that vulnerability and doing it. Because realistically, as you said, it's this stress inoculation, and it'll help in those situations in which your cognitive bandwidth gets narrowed. So if you have this muscle memory about even simple things like where your gear is placed in the kit that you're using, or knowing the exact steps of cannulating and having practiced that muscle memory over and over and over again, your cognitive bandwidth won't be as narrowed as it might be if you hadn't practiced that. My main question as well here would be, how does building your resilience shield sort of in this, I guess, personal life of yours, like, you know, making sure you're building your mind, body, social layers and your professional layer, how does that actually relate to or improve your performance in the job?
Well, when you ask a question like that, you need to look at this from a systems perspective. And what I mean by that is we all are part of various systems. And so we tend to focus in on one system. And so for a paramedic, that might be their role within their ambulance organisation or whatever paramedic role they're doing. For me, that was as a doctor within whatever unit I was a part of. But you don't exist in a bubble. You're not just kept in a can and sort of opened up and let loose for work. And so there's all these other systems that you're a part of and you play a role in. And if they're not optimised, if you're not looking after yourself in those other systems, you cannot turn up to your work role the best version of yourself possible, and therefore you cannot perform at the highest possible level. And I mean, when we look at something like the ability to switch off after work when you get home, to have some psychological transitions, to be able to say, right, work's done, take a few deep breaths, now I'm on to my after work time or family time or whatever that looks like for you. If you don't have some psychological strategies like a meditation practice or a mindfulness practice that can help wind you back down and help to turn off that fight or flight mechanism that we know is in overdrive with first responder occupations, the literature is overwhelming in paramedicine that the occupation is killing the people who do it. It's plain and simple, and you can't sugarcoat that. It is the rates of psychological, psychiatric and physical health ailments are just through the roof in paramedicine, over and above, you know, other occupations for the same demographics. And so, I mean, this is a stressful job, and if you just stay constantly wound up with this chronic stress response thing going on, then it's going to likely lead to a mental or physical health. So the ability to switch off, to be able to flush the nonsense out of your brain, to be able to have other interests outside, to be able to regulate your sleep and optimize your sleep. We know the once again, literature on sleep deprivation is pretty damning, and most of us walk around sleep deprived. And then you chuck in the stress of a role as a paramedic and some shift work. Guess what? You're doing 3 days, three lates, three nights, 4 days off. You know, and your sleep patterns are scrambled. You're not getting the right amount of sleep. Your body's not regenerating from a physical or mental perspective. So therefore, you're not turning up to work the best version of yourself. Heaven forbid you start to feel a few chinks in your mental armor, and so you start pouring alcohol on that, which is a pretty common maladaptive coping strategy in our society and certainly in first response organizations. Then you're turning up to work. That'll ruin your sleep further, turning up to work a little bit hungover and these sort of things. So to bring it right back to your question, all of those other layers of the resilient shield are fundamental to optimizing you in your professional layer as a paramedic. You need to be looking after all of it. You can't just be a good paramedic and be a shambles in all other aspects of your life. It just doesn't work that way.
Absolutely. And I think it definitely comes back to what we started out with in terms of being very proactive and being your own hero in this journey. And I guess that starts with, you know, practicing this as a student or practicing this whilst you're quite young in the job. And it's not too late if you've been in for a while, but, you know, doing this now nice and early. And I think it comes back to that really interesting, you know, graphic you use in the book of the scale, the resilient stress scale of having, you know, when stress is tipped that scale down. And most people will generally think about, what can I do to get rid of stress in my life, rather than, as you mentioned in the book, what sort of things can I do to proactively build that resilience layer to prevent that stress from tipping the scale in the future. So I think, yeah, I think it comes back to that real proactive sort of nature of what we're talking about here.
Yeah, absolutely. And then that's that whole get active in your own rescue piece. But I think the other equally as important piece here is this isn't about heroic measures. This isn't about 3 hours a day meditating or running ultra marathons or these sort of things. Another mantra throughout the book is always a little further, which is a small passage from a larger play that has relevance to the special operations community, particularly the British SAS. But this always a little further is another philosophy that we love. It's about small, incremental, sustainable, habitual practices that just move you in the direction of building and maintaining resilience. And a lot of it's pretty easy to do. Most paramedics, I think, when they read the book will say, well, I knew that, or that makes sense, or this checks out. It's not there's no real rocket science. But then when you ask most people in general, well, are you doing it? They'll be like, well, no, you know, I'm too busy to eat well, or I couldn't do my workout this. And so it is a discipline, but it doesn't need to be massive heroic measures. As I said, it's the always a little further principle that really gets you there in the end.
I love the fact that you sort of bring up the fact that a lot of the time we don't really sort of go with what we say. I feel like a lot of healthcare professionals can sort of fall into the trap of do what I say, not what I do, and might not be making the healthiest of choices.
It's like car mechanics. They will spend their whole day working on everyone else's car and then drive home in a piece of crap that breaks down every other week. And I think it's the same with healthcare professionals. They know the principles underpinning it, but it's a whole different beast to live them.
Yeah, definitely. So I think that sort of brings me to, I guess, one other concept that I'm really interested in, and it's something that I've noticed a lot with paramedics, and I think it will have a lot of, I guess, correspondence over to the special forces world. But you sort of touched on it a little bit in the book, but this concept of, I guess, tiered goals. So from, I guess, like my own experiences and like with friendships with others, that concept of you've got that big goal that you have as your, you know, your main one. So I guess for yourself is the world of SAS selection. You know, that's that goal that you're working hard and you're striving to achieve, but the risk of the plateau afterwards, which I don't think a lot of people really have an awareness of. So I think for students, it's that moment you've been handed your degree, you can call yourself a paramedic, and then it's sort of sitting there and going, what now? Where do I go to now? So any of those special forces worlds with that selection course, whether it's, you know, the commandos or clearance divers or SAS, have you found it sort of shifting that mindset to having more of those tiered goals, those smaller, more attainable moments along the path rather than that one big all in or nothing sort of thing has helped, I guess, with the resilience following the event?
Absolutely. And you make an excellent point. And as you rightly point out as well, most people, I think, will be under the misconception that happiness is in the achievement of the goal. And there's a great quote, I don't know who to attribute it to, but it's that a mountain only looks like a mountain when you're climbing it. And so once you get to the top, it doesn't look like a mountain anymore because you're on top, you're looking around. And I think that that's those two things, understanding that the happiness and the fulfillment as a human being is not in the attainment of the goal. It's in the struggle towards the goal. And, you know, the two steps forward, one step back, all that good stuff that eventually, hopefully, gets you to where you were headed. But even if it doesn't, is moving you forward and you're spending your time productively and with lofty aspirations. And so, yeah, certainly I do think it's important to continually evolve. I think it's important to, for me personally, everyone's wired differently, but for me to have these aspirational goals to be able to focus myself. But equally, I think it's important, and this talks to the concept of growth mindset versus fixed mindset. So fixed mindset is pass, fail, either I'm a success or a failure. You know, it's binary, where growth mindset is all about development and mastery and moving, constantly evolving. And whether you get to the goal or not, is often inconsequential. And I did not achieve all that I wanted to in the military or in the special forces. I never finished enough of my what's called reinforcement training to become qualified as an SAS soldier. And I mean, that was my plan from the outset. That was the goal, to be a qualified doctor. And I never got there. But in striving towards that, I had this amazing series of opportunities. And if I hadn't have set the goal at where it was, I never would have started on that pathway there. So and when I look back now, I realize it didn't make any difference whether I finished that goal or not. I had the experience that I wanted to in the organization. So yeah, but likewise, I think there is also a trap you can fall into where you hit a goal and then immediately move the goalposts and say, right, now I'm here, I'm going to move it there. I think there is also a role there to sit with your achievement and reflect and, you know, pat yourself on the back, pop a bottle of champagne if that's your thing, and just enjoy it, celebrate your victories. And they might be small victories. They don't need to be graduating paramedicine or getting into the SAS. This can be just, I strung together a week of decent training, or I did this, that, or the other. And so celebrate these things. You know, don't constantly get to a goal, achieve it, and then set a new one, because then so it's a happy medium between those two, I think.
How did you sort of find, I guess, that moment, you know, finishing SAS selection? I'm guessing you were probably broken, bruised, and beyond hungry. But I guess, like, the flip side of that for the students, you know, they're finishing the degree. I always refer to the degree as a marathon. Like, they need to have that moment of rest and recovery, which I guess in a different way was sort of that similarity to you. How do you sort of find is, you know, and everyone I do understand has their own way of doing it, but that recovery phase to be able to build yourself up and know when to start pushing for that next goal, or when to, I guess, bring yourself back in. Is that how you sort of found that mindfulness being a helpful tool to bring that balance back into play?
I do find mindfulness a great tool for that now. I didn't sort of discover mindfulness as a tool until after I left the military. I really wish I had of. I think it would have been a fantastic tool to be using at the time when I was in the high-stress environments. But for me, I'm a, believe it or not, very introverted person, so I quite enjoy my own company. And so the ability for me, after I've had a period of intense work towards something, or something that's been quite stressful, and you might achieve that goal, or it's you've reached the end of that process, I like time to myself to sort of reflect and regenerate. And I'm better now at not setting a new goal immediately, so just giving myself a little bit of time to sit with what I've done. And because we can ramp ourselves up and fuel ourselves on stress hormones, and if we recalibrate to that new normal, then when that stress load comes off, it can feel abnormal. We can feel twitchy, and we look for something to fill that void. But I now try and let myself sit with that kind of twitchiness and that feeling of desire to do something again for a period of time until I'm ready and the right thing presents. So I think having a pause between things like professional qualifications, or, you know, and I guess any marathon runners out there or whatever else would attest to this. If you train up and do a race, then you need a physical recovery period afterwards to then build back up again. And I think the same should be said for professional goals or psychological challenges.
That's a really good point. And I definitely think, you know, especially for all the cohort who will probably be listening to this now, who've just recently graduated and, you know, trying to, you know, fulfill the next part in their professional or, educational sort of journey. So I think it's a really important point that you bring up about resting before you go on and do that. So I feel like we've picked your brain quite a lot today. So we do really appreciate that. And I feel like we could keep talking and asking you lots of questions because, you know, you're a wealth of knowledge. So thank you. But I just wanted to finalize on just one last question, just to get, what is your advice for all of the students or the grads out there who on this journey of either, you know, finding resilience or building their resilience, in these sort of stressful situations?
I think ultimately it boils down to just being kind to yourself, trying not to take it all seriously. Probably sounds like a bit of a throwaway, but really trying to keep some perspective on what's going on and to try and not find time, but make time to have a healthy balance, and, you know, use your leave periodically. Don't be one of these people who holds it sort of as some form of accomplishment that they haven't taken a day of leave in 3 years. That's not what it's all about. You know, take your leave when you need it. Put your hand up if you're struggling a bit. I know that's hard, and a lot of first responder communities don't really promote an environment where you can put your hand up. But, you know, if you've had a significant incident or a stress, acknowledge that that's abnormal, and that's a trauma load that's going in, whether or not you find it affecting you at the time. I'd encourage everyone out there to go and see a psychologist, no matter how mentally well you are. Get in touch with a psych and just touch base. I mean, these people have got the strategies and the tools. It's like a physio for your brain, I guess, or a mechanic for your car. Don't wait for your car to break down to take it to the mechanic. Get it serviced once in a while, and that's what your psychologists can do, and just leaning on those around you within your own community is great from a paramedic perspective, but also making sure that doesn't come at the cost of maintaining relationships with key people in your life, your family members, your loved ones outside of paramedicine. I mean, they won't understand the stress of your role as a paramedic. Other paramedics will get it because they've lived it, but don't hold other people accountable for not understanding the stress of being a paramedic. It's not that they don't want to, it's just that they can't. And so, you know, maintain those relationships, maintain a healthy balance outside of your work. As I said before, be enthusiastic in your role. Really get in there, be the first to put your hand up when there's a training opportunity, and don't be sort of shy or feel too vulnerable. Get in there, train, build that stress inoculation. That's the stuff that'll make you better on the day and give you more confidence. Sorry, that's not really one thing. I've gone off on a rant there. I apologize for that. But yeah, all of those things.
Awesome.
And read Resilient Shield.
Absolutely. I was about to plug that. I was about to say everyone needs to go read The Resilient Shield or listen to it if that's your vibe, or even go and do the Resilient Shield survey on the website. I'll pop that into the show notes so you can just click on all the links to get everything, all these amazing resources, and I think that's an awesome way to sort of start your journey on this. So thank you to both Britt and Dan for coming on today. I really appreciate it.
Look, that's an absolute pleasure. If I can get one last plug in before we wrap up, it's for a company called Guardian. And Guardian is a company I've just come on board as a director. It was founded by two intensive care paramedics that work on the special operations retrieval team down here in South Australia. And it has a keen focus on occupational violence and raising awareness for paramedics in that occupational violence space. And that's based on the fact that the statistics for occupational violence in paramedicine are horrendous, and the assault rates on paramedics are through the roof. Mm. And it's acknowledged internationally that this is a problem and there's room for improvement in the training. And so Guardian is in that space. And so that you can hop on the website and you can have a look at that. We've got an online course if that's something you're interested in. But the hope is just to build awareness. We're using a bit of our background. I'm coming in from that perspective of having played in the tactical medical space, all that situational awareness and that high threat awareness and that scene assessment and that escalation, de-escalation techniques up to and including physical de-escalation if the worst case happens. That's where Guardian's interested. So if I can just plug that, have a look at that.
Absolutely. I'll pop that into the show notes as well. So thanks for listening to this episode of the Student Paramedic Podcast. You can connect with us on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, or you can email us at thestudentparamedicpodcast@gmail.com.